welcome back to In Search of Black Power. I'm your host, Lawrence Grand Prix. So we're going to do a video episode for those on the YouTube channel. I believe this will also be released in audio. So those on the YouTube channel will see our Director of Public Policy, Davon Love, presenting in what looks like a bar. It's actually the lobby of Center Stage, which is a venue here in Baltimore. In Baltimore, we're doing a lot of the work around reparations for the war on drugs. And as the talk suggests, there is increasing conversation about reparations. We would argue potentially increasing confusion about reparations. And the talk is really designed in part to give details about the work we're doing. But really, it's more designed to give some of the theoretical, historical, and conceptual foundation for our work. While reparations is increasingly talked about as repairing the gulf between oppressor and oppressed through integrating the oppressed into the systems of the oppressor, narrated positively as the oppressor groups sharing their ill-begotten privilege with those they've oppressed, we at LBS pull our vision of reparations from, we believe, what is its true historical antecedents, which are from the Pan-African Revolutionary and Black Nationalist tradition. And we see reparations through a lens of repair, as in those who have done the harm, giving the resources to the oppressed group to repair the social, political, and economic fabric of their own communities so they can build their own institutions that reflect what they had before the oppression happened. So in post-colonial nations, this is looking back to pre-colonial systems and having people invest in recreating those systems or versions of them in the future. And it makes sense when you talk about nations like Ghana, nations like Ethiopia, Kenya, redressing the colonial metropole, Great Britain, France, for investments in their society that they will then autonomously choose what to do with that money. But when you apply that same logic to African Americans here in the United States, that tends not to be how we conceptualize reparations. We conceptualize it more as get access to welfare, food stamps, healthcare, education, as opposed to getting the investments to build our own institutions. So this talk is really designed to build some of the theoretical foundations behind that, introduce some of the scholars that have been foundational to our work, and really give the audience a sense of the theoretical and historical grounding that's guiding the political work we're doing here in Baltimore. If you want to support that work here in Baltimore, please go to our website, lbsbaltimore.com. We run on monthly donations. We call them sustainers, and it really helps do the work that you're hearing about in the podcast. One thing that I say when we give talks on this issue is that we've been working on this issue of using cannabis legalization to get the tax revenue from that, invest in the community impacted by the war on drugs for almost 10 years now. And there are no 10-year grant cycles. We've been doing it out of our own pockets with our own time because we have a business model that's focused on independence, which allows us the freedom to pursue policy pathways that either aren't funded by foundation grants or can't be funded by foundation grants. One thing I realized is that many foundations were reticent to fund cannabis legalization advocacy on the front end, as in before the bill was passed, cooking the bill, as it were, designing where the tax revenue would go, because that could be seen as a nonprofit foundation paying people to advocate for the legalization of a substance that was federally illegal. And not only could that produce political backlash, that could produce backlash from the federal government in terms of challenging their tax-exempt status as foundations and nonprofits. So many foundations and nonprofits come in on the back end after a state has already legalized the drug, arguing that, well, it's already legal, so it's politically safer for us to focus on the business side, focus on micro-grants and community, as opposed to really working hard on the front end for years and years, as lobbyists do, as many other special interests do, to bake the language into the law itself that does the redistribution in an equitable way. And that's what we've done here in Maryland. That's what we're working to roll out here in Baltimore. We're also explaining some of the theory as to why we view local control and community control as central to a reparations tradition, and view our vision of reparations from the community control, local control movements of the 1960s and 1970s, an explicitly black power political tradition, and what is increasingly, honestly, integrationist reparations movement in terms of national nonprofit and foundation spaces. So with that, please go to our website, lbsbaltimore.com, and please enjoy this talk from Davon Love on reparations.
Let's give it up.
All right. Good evening, everyone. I want to first thank Center Stage for organizing this event. Give them a round of applause. Also want to thank Scott Patterson and Kima Flight for your performances this evening. Give them another round of applause, please. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about reparations as a larger frame, and that's going to empty into the conversation about the specific legislative work that LBS has been and continues to be engaged in, and then I'll entertain some questions. I'll say a little bit more about Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We're a grassroots think tank, as was mentioned before. We have what I would describe as a revolutionary Pan-African nationalist perspective, understanding the importance of black people collectively practicing sovereignty as the basis for our ability to practice freedom in this larger society, which is really a fundamental human condition, or a fundamental human right that human beings, in order to be able to practice freedom, is an essential feature. And I'm going to delve a little bit more into that. But first, like I said, I want to just give some framing. There are three different registers to discuss history. There's history as a series of chronological events. There's the notion of historicity, one's relationship to the forward flow of human history. And then there's historiography, right? The dynamics, the power dynamics that determine which narratives of history are made most available. I want to talk about the notion of historiography. It's important when we think about our contemporary society that is the project of European domination of the world, that is the defining feature of the past 500 years of human history. So when you think about the European Renaissance, the notion of truth through science, right, the emergence of Europeans, really as the last branch of the human family to enter the arena marked as civilization, as John Henry Clark once said, that when you think about the fact that everything that this society had, the intellectual architecture of the society is structured in such a way that is predicated on the notion of white supremacy and notions of black inferiority. In fact, so much so, when you think about, for instance, the academic discipline of Egyptology that emerges in the 19th century primarily to theorize the ancient Egyptians out of African history into European history, right? An entire academic discipline. Understanding that if ancient Africans have civilization to contribute to human society, then the justification for enslavement falls apart, right? And so there was an intentional effort. It was a part of the cultural personality that Europe had to develop in order to justify its exploitation of Africans. And if you look at many of the foundational European scholars in the European canon, Hegel, who described Africa as a place where history doesn't happen, right? It's important to note that that canon and the basis of the kind of cultural ethos of Western civilization requires the notion of the denigration of people of African descent. And that's important because, as John Henry Clark also once said, that if all we know about the history of black people is enslavement, then everything else looks like progress. And that is an important framework to understand that we operate, we're socialized to operate within the European imagination. And while operating within the European imagination and thinking about the societal propaganda of notions of black inferiority, I mentioned some of the examples of ancient society, but even contemporary society, when you think about, for instance, the term crack baby, which is a pop culture term, it has no medical basis, right? But it's a term that emerged concurrent with the war on drugs. Birth of a Nation, first motion picture film that depicted, you know, black people's inherently brutal, is prone to criminality. So these are the tropes that are a part of the collective American consciousness, and they're so embedded in the collective American consciousness that, in fact, notions of white supremacy and black inferiority are rational beliefs given the propaganda that's made most available to us. It's important to recognize that because one of the things as a conceptual frame is for us to understand people of African descent before the intervention of Europeans into the lives of people of African descent. And I would argue that for many of us, our consciousness is so molded by notions of white supremacy and European domination that many of us could not imagine the notion of Africans operating in arenas marked as high levels of civilization, right? In fact, I'll tell a story that I tell pretty often, that I was a debate coach years ago, and I was teaching with a gentleman who was very learned in African history. He said, "Daywon, you know Europeans were traveling the Atlantic Ocean before Europeans were." And my first thought was, you know, why do we always have to have these conspiracy theories of black people doing stuff first? You know, we already have the sociological evidence of racism in this society. It makes it harder for people to believe us. And then I came across a YouTube video of Ivan Van Sertima giving a lecture about they came before Columbus, and then I read the book. And there were two conclusions that I came to. The first was that not only were Africans traveling the oceans before Europeans, where Europeans were the last people to think the world was flat. In fact, Europeans were like the laughingstock of the world to believe the world was flat. But the other thing that I had to ask myself was, why was I so willing to be dismissive of the idea of Africans navigating the oceans? And I had to conclude that I had internalized notions of white supremacy that made it difficult for me to imagine Africans operating at those high levels of civilization. So that's important in thinking about our collective consciences about ancient African societies, because often culture in this society is rendered to mere artifacts instead of a resource, right? That many of the technologies and methods and instruments of human organization often use Greece and Rome as their intellectual and cultural resources as the basis for how they develop. That's why there's a lot of Latin in legal scholarship. Right, that's why even many of the buildings, the government buildings, are modeled after Greece and Roman architecture, because there's an understanding of the rich cultural resources that serve as the basis for the development of this society. But again, many of us aren't familiar with the fact that, for instance, the first medical doctor, Imhotep, who is actually named in the Hippocratic Oath, he's called a Greek name, but Hippocrates, who was the so-called father of medicine, right, talks about his teacher, Imhotep, right, who precedes him, right? And so when you think about Pythagorean theorem, right, Pythagoras studied in Egypt, right? And if you look, and all you got to do is look at the pyramids to look at the kind of mathematical and engineering expertise that you see in ancient Africa. They're practicing cesarean sections in ancient Africa. There was a particular technology around smelting steel, where in what is modern-day Tanzania, they were smelting steel 1,500 to 2,000 years before Europeans were, using semiconductor technology, right? Using electric current as the basis for being able to smelt steel. So there's a large array of examples. I'll give one last example. Ivan Van Sertima actually talks about in his book on black people in science. He narrates a person who was in the Cairo Museum, and there was an exhibit of birds. And he notices, the person notices that one of the structures in the exhibit was not a bird. He noticed that there were wheels on it. And in inspecting that structure, what they realized is that it was an aerial gliding device that predated, I think it was in the 1950s when this story happens, that predated it by about 1,000 years. And the reason they put it in the section with ancient bird species is because it was beyond their scope of imagination that Africans would have thought to develop an aerial gliding device. And again, the way that we are socialized in this society, for many of us, again, people who don't have overt beliefs of black inferiority, there's some of us that notion is an offensive thought to us, offensive to the very logics that we've internalized because of the narrative of this society being the most advanced society that's ever existed. One last example, and this actually, when you think about our family, our Native American family, when you look at the establishment of the American Constitution, American democracy as some kind of miraculous experiment in democracy, Europeans who had not practiced democracy in Europe came over to the United States, magically developed a system of governance that they had never practiced before. Right? That sounds ridiculous. That's because it is ridiculous. Because they borrowed heavily from the practice of democracy of the Iroquois nation in the northeastern region of what is now the United States. Right? So it's I go through all of that, which may in some ways seem unrelated to the conversation of reparations, to talk about the fact that the framework that is often used to talk about people of African descent is from the perspective of us primarily being victims of European domination. And while we are victimized by that system, we are more than just the oppression that governs the society that we live in. And unfortunately, when you think about the way that our suffering is narrated, it's narrated in such a way that is a paternal relationship to Black people, right? That in many ways, some of the folks that see themselves as our allies, that they relate to us the way that people relate to their pets. You love them, they're cute, right? But your relationship to your pet is primarily one of a superior-inferiority relationship, right? That you don't see that pet as having the capability to take care of itself, right? And one of the things that colonialism has robbed us of is a very basic notion that emerges from nature, which is that you don't have to teach a worm what to do to survive. It knows what to do to extract from this world, to perpetuate its species. It's a very natural impulse, right? And that is something that people of African descent has been robbed of because of the societal propaganda from popular culture, academia, and the institutions that are responsible for socializing us. So I'm going to transition to some of our work on police accountability. Because when you think about the images of police brutality and the way that those images were circulated nationally, that one of the basis, again, many activists that I think mean well, the basis for their discussion about police brutality was about trying to get white people to recognize the humanity of people of African descent. And going back to that notion of historiography, that is the frame that we're taught history through. The frame we're taught is that there was racist white people and Martin Luther King came along and there was this moral awakening where they recognized our suffering and that they saw us being bit by dogs and shot by water hoses, and they had this moral awakening and decided to not be racist anymore, right? And that is the historiography that we're given as to how we're taught to think about people of African descent. But when you think about, like, what ended enslavement, right? It wasn't a moral awakening, right? When you think about the Haitian Revolution, right, that inspired rebellions all throughout the 18th and 19th century, right, that put pressure on the American North, for whom economically they could sacrifice enslavement because they had been further industrialized. The South was an agricultural economy, so they were less willing to give up enslavement, right? But those rebellions from the North, combined with the economic competition they were engaging with the South, made it in the North's interest to decide they wanted to end enslavement, right? So it wasn't a benevolence that caused the end of enslavement, but it was people of African descent operating with a level of autonomy and sovereignty that forced this country to end enslavement. And similar to the civil rights movement, when you think about Brown versus Board of Education and the civil rights movement, they were concessions to Cold War politics. So what actually gets Black people progress in the society is not petitioning white people to recognize our humanity, but it's building the power necessary to force the society to make the concessions that it makes. And so, unfortunately, I think too many activists have been socialized with this notion around petitioning white people to recognize our humanity as the basis for their activity. And what you saw a lot was those images of our suffering. And the idea is if we just expose white people to our suffering, they'll change. Well, LBS took a very different posture. The Black Freedom Struggle, when you think about the Black Liberation Army, for instance, or the Black Panther Party, and one of the places where there was actually coalition between some of the more moderate civil rights organizations would emerge from the 60s and 70s, in addition to the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Fair Housing Act, was community control of public resources, particularly community control of law enforcement. And so that was the posture that LBS took, that the greatest deterrent to brutality against our community is our community being armed with the power to discipline those, to punish those that harm folks in our community, right? The institutional power to do so, right? And what we experienced was that there were attempts at political leadership in this state to obscure the notion of community power, community control, right? And to give us things like body cameras or more training, which is good, but that's not power, right? So when we go to reparations, we saw that recreational cannabis was a political inevitability in Maryland as it was being legalized in states around the country. And we were clear that there was an economic opportunity. And so we set out to advocate. Now, we understand the importance of Black people getting into the business, but we were also clear that the communities impacted by the war on drugs should not receive compensation predicated on participation in the industry. So that's why we focused on the tax revenues. And so the idea being that as a condition for legalizing recreational cannabis in the state of Maryland, that we would do our part in using the political power that we've been able to develop over our 13 years of existence to ensure that it does not pass unless there is reparations to the communities impacted by the war on drugs. And so what we were able to do in 2022, when both presiding officers in the State House had decided that cannabis was going to be legalized, that what we did was we, with the help of Senator Joe Carter, who had a piece of legislation that had the community repair and reinvestment fund that was mentioned earlier, where there was a leadership bill that actually had a different fund that was more like a traditional nonprofit in state government. And we were able to get four of the Black senators on the Finance Committee to organize themselves to essentially condition that bill moving out of the committee on our language from Senator Carter's bill being put into the bill that would eventually move out of the Senate to establish that fund. That what that fund does is a few things. One is that 35% of the revenues from recreational cannabis goes into this fund. Each jurisdiction gets a percentage of that fund. That percentage is determined by that jurisdiction's contribution to statewide cannabis possession charges from 2002 to 2023. The idea being that those jurisdictions that were hit the hardest will get the largest percentage of the resources. And that each jurisdiction has to pass a law that determines how they spend their portion of those resources. Because one of the things about reparations, and the reason why I started the way I started, is because it's not merely just about investing in the community, right? Because in some ways, investing in the community has turned into investing into a white-controlled nonprofit industrial complex that profiteers off of our suffering. So a key part of reparations is about Black people's control over the resources to build the institutions needed for us to practice the sovereignty we once were able to practice before the past 500 years of European domination of the world, right? And so each jurisdiction determining how it spends its portion of those resources was important to empower the community with the maximum opportunity to be able to impact how those resources are distributed. And so that was established in 2022 and 2023. The Baltimore City Council established the Baltimore Reinvestment and Reparations Commission. In fact, on Tuesday in Prince George's County, modeling their legislative mandate off of what we did in Baltimore City, calling theirs the Community Restoration and Reinvestment Board, essentially passed their bill, actually this past Tuesday, and we're working with folks in Montgomery County to do something similar. So I'll end by saying this, is that one of the ways that white supremacy operates in our consciousness is that we, as I mentioned, the historiographical perspective of petitioning white people to recognize our humanity, and I think so many of us are conditioned to think that way, then when Black people are able to win on our own terms, for some people it's hard to even fathom. Because again, so much of what we get exposed to is us trying to get white people to like it enough to move it along. And one of the things I'm most proud of at LBS is that our base is Black people, right? Now, people that want to, anybody that wants to support LBS is welcome to support us, but our base, who we're accountable to, is Black people. And what I'm most proud of is that our proof of concept is that that base is the source of our power to be able to accomplish the things that we're able to accomplish. When people earlier on in our career would tell us, all that Black stuff's not going to work, you're eventually going to have to grow up and do this the way that everyone else gets stuff done. And what I'm most proud of is that we've been able to do the work that we've been able to do, being accountable to Black people, being reliant on our base and our community as our source of power. No white people have veto power over what we do. And we're able to engage white people from a position of power, right? We're able to reject their benevolence and their paternalism, right? And to the extent that white people engage us, they understand that. And it is that position that is the most effective instrument for Black liberation. So anyone that tells you that you got to figure out how to make sure that white people are comfortable enough with you, right, in order to have an impact on the community, I submit to you that LBS is one of many examples of the notion of Black sovereignty as the basis for being able to be an effective advocate to deliver material conditions and changes to Black people. So I'll stop there and entertain any questions you all have.
No, I just wanted to say, you know, really appreciate, you know, your stance on reparations. Whenever I've been in the conversation of reparations, it's always towards the bent that it was something that can be given to us, as opposed to something that we really have to take. I mean, we really have to have for ourselves with our own hand. We grab with our own hand. We build with our own hand. So I just wanted to say, you know, I really appreciate that take on it. As far as it being a thing of controlling economics, as opposed to having economics given or poured onto us, you know, being able to have our own communities, healthy communities, what it means to us to be a healthy community, like that to me is real reparations. But then there's also the thing, the biggest thing I really appreciated was the idea of policing that, because to me, a healthy community, a healthy Black community, in a white supremacist society is a dangerous thing. You know, if our societies have been the mules for our country, if all of a sudden the mule is like, I'm no longer a mule, I'm a Mustang, and I roam free, that's a dangerous animal. You know, not to say that we're animals, but you know, and so I just really appreciate that take on reparation, and I agree with you.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate that.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Forgive me if I go off topic, but I'm new to the city, and it seems like there's a lot of focus and investment on home ownership. Now, I was just wondering if your organization was part of some of the discussions around shaping policy and how that looks, or just kind of what your thoughts are as far as that, as far as helping to build up like the economic base of people of color.
So I'll say a few things. The first is that while I work, we don't have direct legislative advocacy on housing. There are folks who we partner with who are. One person that I want to mention, I was actually with her last night, Ms. Denise Jones Dorsey is working with the Community Land Trust here in Baltimore looking at increasing Black home ownership. So I would encourage people to look at her work. One of the things I will say in addition to that is that, you know, one of the things that happens when we talk about particularly Black economic power is that there are times where there's a slippage between conversations around individual Black people accumulating wealth or a handful of Black people accumulating wealth versus collective wealth creation. And while individual Black people being able to access wealth is important, I think it's important that we're, and not saying that you're doing this, but I think it's important that we're clear the distinction to get to collective wealth creation for the masses of Black people that don't have access to the instruments of wealth creation requires political power, right? And policy that distributes wealth in a way that working class Black people have access to. And looking at models of ownership that aren't just relying on, you know, singular individual people owning property, but looking at, you know, democratic ways of Black folks collectively having ownership of property, land, and all kinds of things in order to ensure that the masses of our community benefit.
I thought there was some mention that Illinois was giving reparations to either Native Americans or African Americans.
So it's a few things. So there's the Evanston, Illinois example, where they took cannabis, recreational cannabis revenues, and took it to assist Black families who wanted to have a down payment on owning a house. Evanston's a suburb of Chicago, as mentioned before. Illinois also, in the past few years, I forget which year it was. Was it 2020 or 2020? So, 2019. Illinois passed it legalized recreational cannabis and established a fund that they call reparative, right? I don't think that we would consider it reparations because it's set up like a very traditional grant program, and much of the resources go to very traditional white-led corporate nonprofit institutions. But they give a substantial amount of resources in the name of being reparative to the war on drugs. So that's what I know about that's happened in Illinois.
We hope you enjoyed that conversation. So we wanted to provide you a little bit of information about how we're planning to go forward in the future. So there'll be two different but related podcasts. One will be more interview focused on YouTube that will usually focus on Davon interviewing someone from our networks. That'll be on the YouTube channel. That may include myself. That may include other folks from LBS, depending on the topic, depending on the situation. And that will be more sporadic. That will be more special episode sort of framing. So with these episodes, we actually want to go back to our previous format. Some of you may know this podcast really started with a little bit of investment we got, and we used that investment to do a real audio-centric, highly produced, traditional podcast. Not like Drink Champs interview-style podcast, but like This American Lifestyle podcast. And while I probably won't have that level of production, we do want to have a consistent release of audio podcasts, because those audio podcasts can, of course, then be uploaded to YouTube. Idea is to essentially continue what we've been doing and doing a little bit of both audio and video, but really space it out so that we can integrate the podcast more into the larger workflow of the things we do here at LBS. We do a lot of political advocacy. We work with a lot of clients to do consulting and research. So the idea is that the topics will stem from research that we're doing and serve to interject our voice into conversations we know people are having. So, for example, my audio podcast, and those audio podcasts will be focused on me, Lawrence Grand Prix, doing analysis that reflects what people are talking about, what I'm hearing, and things you may be hearing, things that may be whispered about, you may vaguely know about, but really don't, maybe haven't gone in depth on. And maybe haven't thought about the implications behind some of these texts you may be hearing. So especially in terms of seminal books and seminal ideas that have been central to the discourse when it comes to Black policy work, Black liberation, these don't usually have a grassroots, deeply researched, theoretical, but Black nationalist and Pan-Africanist voice speaking on them. And we see it as our role to fill that gap in the discourse. So for example, we want to release these audio podcasts potentially every 2 months as life allows us to. But we want to try to be consistent because, for me at least, I know these voices are very prominent in the discourse. And there isn't anyone contextualizing those views who has a different set of political assumptions or different set of political histories or different set of political solutions they want to put forward. So similar to how this talk can be seen as a challenge to some of the orthodoxy around reparations, we want to do similar podcasts that challenge orthodoxies around a variety of issues, whether that be how do we get bills passed? What's the best strategy to pass race-conscious policy post the Supreme Court overturning affirmative action? How do we think about what's happening in the human social service sector around trauma and the trauma-informed care movement? Are these folks allies? Are these folks we should challenge? How do we think about the public health sector and public health solutions to a variety of social problems? So it will be an extension of some of the topics we've talked about in the past, but really designed to focus on text or ideas that we know are prominent in the discourse that you may be being asked to read for class, that you may be, hey, did you read this book given to you by a coworker, or something you might get in a workshop, a professional development workshop. These ideas start to get credence, but there's no one really contextualizing them or speaking alternative ways of thinking about the problems they propose. So I don't want to call it a book review podcast. I don't really think what I'm going to do is a review. Maybe a book contextualization or idea contextualization audio podcast. So I'm going to try to produce those as consistently as possible, hopefully on this bi-monthly as in every other month's framework. And again, if this content is valuable, we see it as trying to respond to feedback and things that we've heard are useful to people. And the more resources we can get, the more time we can take away from the other work we have to do to create this content for you all. So if you can, please go to lbsbaltimore.com/sustain. You can sign up for as low as $5 a month. All this money helps us not just keep the lights on, but pay for equipment for the podcast, pay for hosting for the podcast, pay for our time really away from going to Annapolis, away from going to City Hall, away from the work we have to do for our clients, to give us the space and time to produce this podcast and produce this content for you all. So again, lbsbaltimore.com. We thank you all who have been with us on this journey so far, and we look forward in whatever way we can to continue to go on this journey in search of Black power. See you soon.